AYRS-LP, Spokane, FM 92.3 and 89.9, www.kyrs.org, 509-747-3807. Welcome to Tech Talk with Hawk. Tech Talk with Hawk is a weekly talk show discussing topics related to technology and its impact on your privacy, security, and civil rights. Content and or views, opinions, and conclusions expressed on Tech Talk with Hawk by the host, co-host, or guest do not necessarily reflect those of KYRS, the Nair Radio, LPFM, nor those of the station's staff or management. The show host is not a lawyer, and the opinions expressed by the show host, co-host, or guests are not to be construed as legal advice.
The opinions and conclusions expressed by the host, co-host, or guest should in no way be construed as an endorsement to purchase any product or service, nor are they intended to discourage anyone from buying any product or service or deprive any company of its lawful income. Furthermore, such opinions and conclusions are not intended to support, induce, or condone any activity that might violate local, state, federal, or international laws. The host, co-hosts, and guests have no liability to any listener or entity deprived from any alleged loss or damage arising from the use or misuse of the information provided during this show, including damage to computer systems, aid systems, equipment, accessories, injury, or any other problems or adverse situations directly or indirectly resulting from the show's content. This show makes no guarantees stated or implied regarding the validity of the information discussed on this show. While the show host makes an effort to ensure the information discussed is accurate, the host, co-hosts, and guests will not be held liable for errors, inaccuracies, omissions, improper use of information presented, or any violations of any law which may occur as a result of utilizing the information from the show or any inconsistency therein.
Has been working with computers and information technology since 1981. He has extensive experience with and has been certified in many technologies over the years, including but not limited to Microsoft, Novell, Sun, Java, Linux, databases, Oracle, information security, application servers, web servers, and many, many other technologies. He has worked as a software developer in many programming languages, worked in most of the areas of the information technology industry, from lowly technical support in custom personal computer systems builder to database administrator, network administrator, systems administrator, computer technician building thousands of systems by hand, webmaster, physical and information security specialist, research and development computer scientist to the pinnacles of Chief Information Officer and Chief Technology Officer. Hawk has worked for tiny mom-and-pop companies to large corporations with tens of thousands of systems. He has been published and certified as an Information Security Incident Handler by the SANS Institute, an institution focusing on information security originally founded by the NSA and the FBI. The goal of this show is to enlighten and inform the general public about technologies that do have an impact on everyone, and try to break the terms down as best as possible to be understood by most listeners. If any topic covered goes by too quickly, or needs to be explained in more detail, please do not hesitate to call in to the studio during show broadcast hours. That's Sundays, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time. You may call in the United States, 509-747-3807. You may also contact the show host during show broadcasts through instant messaging and internet relay chat by going to the website www.techtalkhawk.com, or during any time you may email hawk at techtalkhawk.com. You may also download show archives, find links and addendum information, as well as post questions at the website www.techtalkhawk.com. That's TechTalkHawke.com. And now, your host, Hawk.
Yes, welcome to Tech Talk with Hawk. Just a little bit of glitch there in the intro I need to fix. I forgot that it mentioned the Sunday time. I'm no longer doing this regularly on Sundays. I do it on Fridays from noon to 1. Sunday from 6 to about 6:15, I just cover headlines kind of just as a read the news headlines. I don't really get into the editorial aspect of technology and its impact on security, privacy, and civil rights. But here on the Friday show, this February the 23rd, 2007. I do opine in addition to covering the headlines. So, get your things rolling along here. One thing is to remind you about if you've missed previous shows, podcasts are now enabled. I had downloads of shows working all along. But for those who prefer to use the automatic informing and subscription methods of podcasting, that is enabled at my website at techtalkhawk.com. And, of course, you can always listen online live to the KYRS internet stream. It simulcasts with the regular terrestrial broadcast at www.kyrs.org. And you'll find a link over on the left to click on that says Listen Now. And you can listen with your favorite media player at your favorite speed. We have streams for both broadband and dial-up users, so nobody will be left out there. All right, let's get rolling with the headlines here. We have... This has been on the mainstream news, so sometimes the mainstream news realizes the impact of technology, privacy, security, civil rights, but a lot of times they miss, you know, like the rest of the headlines I'll mention here are not mentioned in the mainstream media, but at least they caught something. Egyptian blogger gets 4 years in prison. This is because he insulted Islam and Egypt's president. He is a 22-year-old former student at Egypt's Al-Azhar University. He was a vocal secularist and sharp critic of conservative Muslims in his blog. And he also lashed out at Al-Azhar, who is also, besides the president, the most prominent religious leader, the most prominent religious center in Sunni Islam. He called it the University of Terrorism, accused it of encouraging extremism. So he's gotten 4 years... for putting his opinion on his blog, and that definitely is something to watch out for. I mentioned other shows, different instances of the law, and lawyers and others harassing bloggers, and some being able to stand up to it, and others unfortunately losing, as another method of free speech is slowly being more and more restricted. A lot of people need to be very concerned that this is going to scare off people having any freedom of expression there in Egypt. And a lot of bloggers are worried. One blogger, while Abbas, says this is a terrible message to anyone who intends to express his opinion and to bloggers in particular. The Committee to Protect Journalists is a New York-based rights group. Said writers and editors are the fastest growing, internet writers and editors are the fastest growing segment of imprisoned journalists with 49 behind bars as of December. So it's just yet another nail in the coffin there for blogging, just to be aware of if you're a blogger out there. Even non-technical people use blogs all over the place. It's getting a little hairier out there, something to watch out for, unfortunately. Let's see. Bill would require ISPs to track users. And I'll give you a little history on this, but first I'll cover the article. A Republican congressman has introduced a bill that wants to require all internet service providers, ISPs, to keep information on their users' identities and their actions online. It was presented earlier this month by Republican Lamar Smith, and he introduced Bill H.R. 837. Now, its stated purpose is to supposedly combat child pornography, but it includes a measure that forces ISPs to monitor all their users. And then, of course, law enforcement's been begging for that forever. It mandates that the U.S. Attorney General determine the exact regulations, but the rules should, at a minimum, require retention of records, or is quote, at a minimum require retention of records such as the name and address of the subscriber, registered user, to whom internet protocol address, user identification, or telephone number was assigned, in order to permit compliance with court orders, end quote. The Smith proposal would give the Attorney General carte blanche to require service providers to keep all information imaginable on every one of their users. The proposed legislation would require that registered sexual offenders give up their online email and website addresses, as they currently must do with their physical address, or as they must make it public. Personal privacy is taking center stage in 2007, following numerous data breaches, worry about government surveillance and the monitoring of employees by corporations. And this is from the securityfocus.com website. So again, that bill is H.R. 837. It's known as the Internet Stopping Adults Facilitating the Exploitation of Today's Youth Safety Act of 2007. And here's Randy. He's just made it in. How you doing there?
Yeah, pretty well.
Appreciate you dropping in. Just talking, I opened up with the talk about the Egyptian blogger who's had to do 4 years in prison for blogging because he was critical of Islam and the president of Egypt.
Really?
And he's been given 4 years for that. Yes, you're on. Yeah, just go ahead and have a seat and enjoy. this is Randy. He regularly shows up on here. I guess the title now is assistant.
Assistant.
Because co-host gets to like touch the keyboard or the console and take over my shows if I'm not here. And guests are, you know, only show up occasionally. So you're kind of in between the two. So the term now is assistant.
Gotcha.
Recurring guest, however you want to phrase it. So, because he doesn't get to touch the console. He can touch the microphone and the headphones and that's about it. Nothing else. No console for you. So Randy's a great guy. He kind of keeps me grounded here. He kind of acts as the everyman for the listening audience to make sure I'm not getting going by too fast or being too technical. And sometimes he plays devil's advocate and goes, "Now wait a minute, you say this, but what about this?" And so he's a great help to the show here, and I'm really glad when he can make it. So thanks for showing up.
So what's going on with this bill?
Well, okay. So first, I was talking about the blogger, the Egyptian. Now this other one is a bill about tracking that requiring ISPs to track users' internet traffic. First of all, make all their personal identifiable information available, like phone number, address, name, all of that. Additionally, track everything you do. And this is a bill that was proposed just a couple of weeks ago, Bill H.R. 837. Supposedly, it's to try to stop child porn. But unfortunately, it impinges, you know, infringes on everybody else's rights as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've been aware of this creeping up over the years. When I had, when I was first looking at starting up a wireless ISP company, which I ended up starting up anyway, one of the options I looked at starting it was the government was offering $50,000 grants for anybody who wanted to do a rural Wi-Fi wireless ISP. And that's pretty good money. You can set up a pretty decent facility for $50,000 in a rural area, and a lot of people took it. But there was a catch. There's always a catch. There's never free money, is there? The catch was that in order to get the grant, you had to set up a server that logged all of your users' traffic, all the time, kept track of every single site, every email, everything that the users ever did. You had to keep a log of. For the government. That was the little stipulation. I actually had the paperwork to fill out the grant, and I was going through it, and I was filling it out and going, "Oh, this is great, oh, okay." And then there was a little fine print clause in there that mandated that as part of the grant.
What agency was offering that?
It's been 4 or 5 years. It was, you know, I followed links here and there. Somebody told me about it, and I followed it. I don't remember which part of the government, but I don't know if they still offer it. They might still be, they might not be, but they were trying to really encourage broadband out to rural areas because there wasn't enough density for big corporations to do it. It wasn't enough profit margin for them, but small businesses could do it and actually make some money, as did with that. So I ended up not doing the grant because I'm a big advocate for privacy and security and civil rights, so I wasn't going to violate that. But I know a lot of other ISP owners, small ISPs in rural areas, did go ahead and take the money and also did set up the server and record all of their users' traffic. And they're supposed to, in their privacy, you know, statements, let people know. Most people never read those. So
my understanding, all that was tracked anyway, and that they just, all they had to do to find out what you were doing was get a subpoena. And it was there.
What's tracked is like when you connect, but they don't track every site you go to and every email you connect with, etc. There's a big difference between saying, at this time of day, this account was connected. Okay, that happens automatically. But the other thing is that normally ISPs let that go after a while. They might keep it for a week, a month, 6 months, a year, whatever. But they let it roll over and go away. The government was mandating that, no, you have to keep backups of these logs indefinitely. Kind of like the IRS saying, you know, you got to have all your receipts and everything for a certain period of time. Mm-hmm. Government is saying, well, you got to have this forever. And So that was the trade-off for getting the $50,000. Mm-hmm. Some people thought it was worth it. I did not, so I ended up just doing it out of my own pocket. And so that was some early efforts I saw of that around 2002, I think, is when I saw that going on. So I'm not surprised that this is happening, because the FBI and others would love to be able to track where everybody goes at all times. And, you know, you can, if you hire a forensics expert, you know, as I was, you know, security expert, to go back and track somebody, you can do it. It just takes a lot more effort. I can go back. So if a site is attacked, I can look at the web logs of that server and see all the IP addresses that connected at that time. I can then find out where that IP address came from, what ISP it is, and then subpoena, you know, I have to go through channels, but have the ISP subpoena their logs for what that time of day from that IP address, and then they can say, well, that was this account. And then either we can just tell them to contact their user and just give them a warning, or they can be subpoenaed to come to court, you know, and have to either A, testify, or B, defend themselves. So those are, you know, one of many, there's many possibilities about those outcomes. So it is possible to backtrack that way. But what this is different about is it's tracking the other direction. So we're talking about tracking towards the user. Here we're talking about every site you go to, there's a log. They don't know, we don't usually log that, because that's a lot of, I mean, that's a lot of hard drive space to log all of. If you have an ISP and you have just 1,000 users, and you're logging every single website they go to and every email transaction they have, because that's the next step. It doesn't say that in here. But the next step is, once you get all the traffic logged, then you want archives of all the emails, because the federal government's been trying to do that, you know, with their little email sniffing program. Well, why not just put the burden on the ISP, since the federal government hasn't been able to get that down right? The FBI has had repeated programs on that, and, you know, they keep getting exposed and then forced to stop, and then they just start up a new program under a different name. So this is just another attempt at that, and so people should be aware of it, and contact your congressman and tell them, no, we don't want to have ourselves invaded. Or if you agree with it, then go ahead and give your support. But personally, I really don't like the idea of every single thing. You know, and some people respond, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, what do I care? And some people just have that attitude. They don't really care that their lives are publicly available.
Well, would it be publicly available, or is it under subpoena only?
Well, okay. It's supposed to be subpoena only. The problem is, the more data you store, the more risk you're at for compromise. And they bring that up in here about how places that have been storing a lot of information on users have been getting hacked, and that information being used against people. So it may not intentionally be publicly available, but the more you put it up there, the more likely that something's going to happen. And still, why? It's just, I think it's just going too far. I mean, there are channels already to backtrack. I mean, this is very, very Orwellian, Big Brotherish, big time, to track everything you do. And the possibilities of abuse of that just are, you know, awful. You have any other?
Oh, I was just comments? Looking at the title, or what it's known as. Who titled it that?
Yeah, isn't that cute? The title, again, is known as The Internet Stopping Adults Facilitating the Exploitation of Today's Youth. Safety, SAFETY, so Stopping Adults Facilitating the Exploitation of Today's Youth, Act of 2007. They always like to have
sounds
those
like
catchy acronyms. Yeah, sounds
like
great. Exactly. That's how they get these things in, like the DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And anyway,
it's interesting how you have to. I mean, I think everybody would agree if I mean, if it was.
Well, so there's a part of this bill. See, this is what they always do. There's a part of this bill that is, I have no argument with, which is they're requiring that the convicted sex offenders. I have a little bit of an argument with that, in that the term for that is a little bit overused. You know, some sex offenders are, you know, they molested children, things like that. Okay, I get why they do what they do. Some of them are like an 18-year-old who got involved with a 17-year-old girl, and some father got upset, and so he got charged with, you know, statutory rape or whatever. It's a little borderline. but it says that basically those who were convicted of sex offenses have to make public their email and website addresses, you know, just like they have to make public their, you know, locally they have to, there's a database, there's a website you can go to, mm-hmm. and you can find out what child sex offenders there are in your neighborhood, mm-hmm. depending upon their ranking of risk level and everything. You can do that online right now. So this is saying, in addition to their home address, now they've got to give up their email and website address. I feel sorry for that, but I get that if your thinking is that all that should be public the way it is right now, then I get that train of thought there being added to that. I can see how that would be, especially with what's going on with, like, MySpace and things like that, where kids are getting tricked by adults, etc. So it creates a hot list, and then that can be used to help create software that protects children, etc. But when they turn it to the general public to do a lot of this information and all the tracking and everything, that's when I go, a little too far there. A lot too far. So that's a concern. So something to be aware of. And, of course, this isn't in the mainstream press at all. It should be. The Egyptian blogger is in the mainstream press. This is on securityfocus.com, oh. This article is.
Is it in committee, or?
It's been submitted. It's just a couple of weeks ago. I don't have any other update.
Be an interesting one to follow.
Yes. It will be something I will follow. So we'll see where that goes. And we already mentioned the Egyptian, and that is in the mainstream press. I've been hearing that on NPR and CNN and
so
everywhere.
What did this Egyptian say?
Well, he's just been, quote, you missed the quote I gave, but in case somebody else is just tuning in, some of the things he said was that he used to be a student at Egypt's Al-Azhar University. He'd been a vocal secularist and sharp critic of conservative Muslims in his blog. Now, you know, that's kind of the whole process of being a college student, is questioning things. I mean, how many revolutions have come from, you know, maybe not successful revolutions, but there have been a lot of uprisings from the college students, you know. And then usually a few years later, then the actual revolution catches on, you know, it spreads to the general populace. Mm-hmm. But he was calling the Al-Azhar University, the most prominent religious center in Sunni Islam, called it the University of Terrorism, and accusing it of encouraging extremism. And he was also a big critic of the president of Egypt as well. And so they gave him 4 years for expressing his opinion.
Is Mubarak, is that still the president?
Let's see. Insulting him. I forgot already who it is. it doesn't actually, it just says the Egyptian president. I think it is Mubarak. That sounds right. I don't know if there's been a recent change in elections or anything. And it doesn't actually state the president's name, but that would be a good guess. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Yet another blow to blogging, unfortunately. Hey, that has some alliteration to it.
Are there, so what is there's an official law on the books. Is that correct, that he violated?
In Egypt, they didn't, let's see, I don't remember reading here, it said Nabil insulted the Prophet Muhammad with a piece he wrote in 2005 after riots in which angry Muslim worshippers attacked a Coptic Christian church over a play deemed offensive to Islam. So, and he was quoted as saying, Muslims revealed their true ugly face and appeared to all the world that they are full of brutality, barbarism, and inhumanity, Nabil wrote in his blog. He called Muhammad and his 7th century followers the Sahaba, spillers of blood, for their teachings on warfare, a comment cited by the judge. So yes, you're not allowed to badmouth Islam in Egypt, is apparently the case.
Hmm.
Yeah. So... But unfortunately, that, you know, makes it scary, because then other countries follow those examples and cite precedent, and yeah. you know, yeah, okay, maybe it's one extreme approach here, but it's just another step closer towards not being able to have your right to voice your opinion. Yeah. And blogging's been a great forum for that.
Did you ever see that documentary? I can't remember who did it. I can't think of the name right now. It was about the guy who, I think it was called Mr. Death.
The assisted suicide, or no?
No,
different one. Okay.
Yeah, his father was a prison guard of some sort, and he grew up around execution chambers, and somehow through his own interests became known as an expert on execution systems, and so states would hire him to perfect their execution chambers or make sure they were in working order when the time came, and. Because of this reputation that he had or experience, someone in Canada, I think it was Quebec, Toronto maybe, I'm not sure, got themselves into hot water saying that the Holocaust was not I don't know if they said it wasn't true, but they said there's no proof for it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, there have been a number of people who discredit it and such.
And the Canadian government arrested him for that and charged him. You don't have the same free speech rights in Canada as you do here. I was interested to find out.
Yeah, that's interesting.
They hired this guy as a witness for them, you know, and it didn't work out. And they ended up, I think, I don't know what the punishment was, but they were convicted.
Wow.
Whatever group it was, I can't remember. But,
that's interesting.
Yeah, I was surprised to find out that Canada had had a restriction.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. You don't. It's we're always just one step away.
Things that were blatantly false, you could not print.
Right.
I think,
but opinion.
Something yeah, it would.
You know, I mean, if that happened in this country, you know, okay, fine. I feel this way, this way, this way.
Right.
Now, people might say, "Hey, that's religious. This, that's racist. This, that's this."
Yeah.
But it's still in a blog. Again, we come back down to, is this a backed official text, or is this just somebody's opinion?
Yeah.
Because, okay, we go from blogs, then what about forums? You know, people like to chat in forums and stuff. There are some forums that are moderated. Now, most of the time, they're just moderated to stop flame wars and swearing and things like that. Some of them are topic moderated. You talk off topic, you get kicked out. Imagine a government mandate if you can't talk off topic. Holy moly. And that does happen. That happens in China. That happens in a lot of countries. And so... Another time to be grateful for what we do have, and also to stand up and keep what we do have, because we can see how ugly it can get.
Yeah. Interesting, though, the dangers. I mean, whoever's after this bill, it said, I think, law enforcement. This has been a
long... Yeah, law enforcement's been trying to get this for years.
So, that's. I mean, you've got that side of it, which we all respect, but, you know, there's that line drawing you have to do. How free of a society do you
that's
want?
Right.
How many dangers do you want to take?
That's and right.
All comes down to how many disasters come from those dangers.
Yeah, safety, you know, versus liberty.
Right.
Yep. Another topic is, this isn't too long, it's the Vista blockade, security measure or business strategy. So it was a catchy headline, but it didn't really, it basically what they're talking about is virtualization. Virtualization allows you to run other operating systems inside of your existing operating system. So let's say, and in this case they're talking about Mac and such. So you're running Mac, OS X, and you can run some software so you can run Windows inside of Mac. Why you'd want to do that, I don't know. But anyway, there are people who want to. And or other operating systems. You could run Linux inside of Mac, things like that. And what Microsoft has done with Vista is say that you're not allowed to do that with the lower-end versions of Vista. You're only allowed to do that with the more expensive version. Let's see the exact quote is. Okay, the price of virtualization software does not include a copy of Windows. You have to get a copy, and you have to agree to Vista's licensing rules, a legally binding document. Lurking in that 14-page agreement is a ban on using the least expensive versions of Vista, the $199 Home Basic Edition and the $239 Home Premium Edition in virtualization engines. You're not allowed to use the cheaper versions in your virtualized machine. You have to instead buy the $299 business version or the $399 ultimate version. Remember I told you there were a lot of Vista versions out there?
Mm-hmm.
That's the breakdown. And that doesn't even include the upgrade version. Remember I was talking about the upgrade version of Vista. So that's, let's see, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 versions of Vista now. Because you have the Home Basic, Home Premium, Business, Ultimate, and then the upgrade, because the upgrade, and each of them has different features crippled. But even if you buy the high-end one, in the virtualized window, you're not, it disables a lot of the features, and you're not allowed to watch media. You can't watch video. You can't listen to music. It cripples all that because, again, the content protection. You know, I did that hour and something show on the Vista copy protection, which is available download from podcasts. That's been a hot download, by the way. A lot of people have been downloading the Vista show. People are emailing me finally about that, and they've been making copies and sending it to their friends on CD and stuff, going, this is what you got to watch out for, man. And so they're, again, what they're saying is, well, the virtual, Microsoft's argument is using a virtual machine is a security risk, and that's possibly true, although it is yet to be proven in the real world. There's a theoretical risk to it, but it's actually been used a lot to be more secure to do testing and such, because you can stick things in this little virtual bubble and do a lot of testing. I used, for my developers and stuff, we used what was called VMware, which is mentioned in this article as well. There's a number of virtual machine products out there, and Microsoft and Novell working together on one as well. But that they've made one of their agreements is between SUSE Linux. Novell has a great virtual engine machine, according to these people. And so Microsoft wanted to work a deal because they want to use Novell's machine, or they want to get improvements from Novell's virtual machine to use in the Vista virtual machine. But anyway, we use virtual machines so that instead of having to, when we launch a new version of the website or we launch a new version of software, you need to test it. You need to have a whole bunch of testers to go through and click, 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 enter data, click, 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 and see if it blows up, find all the bugs. Well, a lot of times that would require like a dozen or more computers, each one with different versions of the operating system. So you might have, you know, a Windows 95 computer, Windows 98 computer, Windows 2000 computer, Windows NT computer, Windows XP computer, a Mac computer of a couple of different versions maybe, Linux computers of a few types, you name it. So you'd have to have all these computers with different configurations to make sure that all these users would be able to use the website or use the software properly. That's a lot of computers. And then you have to maintain all of them, keep them updated, etc. So instead of virtual machine is, you just have one computer and you could run like four operating systems simultaneously inside of there. You have them in a little window in each corner of your thing and go, okay, here's Windows 95, here's Windows 98, here's Windows 2000, here's Linux, all running inside, and be testing. Go click, 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 test the same functionality and do a check mark on your checklist. It all worked under all operating systems. Go to the next step, click, 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 click. Really, really effective. And very handy. So we used it a lot. And then I used it just for testing stuff out when a new version of something would come out. It'd be a way to test it without really solely, you know, committing an entire computer to it or having to dual boot or do any of that. So it's a handy function. And Microsoft's doesn't like it. They've actually, a number with both 2000 XP, they put updates out that made it so that the existing virtual engine machines at the time would quit working. So you wouldn't be able to get those updates and still be able to virtualize that version of Windows. Of course, the virtual engine people just turned around and figured out a workaround to that each time, but it's been a back-and-forth battle. So, and Microsoft's argument for that is like, well, people are pirating. They're pirating. These virtualizing people are pirating. They're like, well, if they're going to pirate, they're going to pirate. It has nothing to do with the virtual engine. It's just a different way to have it installed. So that was... So it's ongoing. So now they're doing that with Vista, and it sounds like they set up Vista to detect if it's in a virtual environment and do everything it can to cripple itself significantly. And, of course, the whole copy protection thing makes it so you can't test media inside of Vista if it's in a virtual machine. So they're having a little squabble with the virtual machine companies in Vista over that. Thoughts?
Well, a few, just out of ignorance, probably.
No, good. That's what you're here for.
over at the launch party, you know, the demonstrators
were showing off the virtual engine. Right?
Yeah, they had server running. They had multiple.
Because they're happy to do it with their own products or host other people's products. What they don't like is if you're running Mac and you have Windows inside of it, because you're not committing to Windows. Or if you're running Mac, you're running Linux and you're running Windows inside of it.
That's interesting because over at the store. People are asking, you know, because OS X and with the Core 2 Duos in them have allowed you to run XP.
Right.
Virtualized.
That's what this is talking about in this article, yes.
And so the question has been, well, what about Vista?
Right.
And there's been, you know, the Mac rep just keeps saying there's no official word from
it's doable.
Apple on it. I guess it's doable,
yeah.
But if no official word, is that because this is going on? That
possibly.
That Microsoft might pull the plug on it?
On the virtualization?
Yeah.
No, they're just... They just launched this product. We go through this with every launch. You know, you remember XP and launch. There's always a flux, and Microsoft doesn't always know what exactly they don't always they make one assumption about what their consumers want, and then get a backlash through the salespeople and everything. Going, no, they want something entirely different from what you're trying to shove down their throats. And then Microsoft has to scramble first through PR and then through software to make the adjustments. When XP first came out. Remember the really, really, really ugly authentication software for XP? You had to be online to enable your version of XP.
Otherwise, it quit in 30 days.
Right. And it was every version of XP had that. You didn't have a choice. That was a support nightmare for people. It was buggy. It had a lot of problems. What was worse is if you changed any of your hardware, it would lock you out. if you changed your hard drive, well, hard drive obviously because you get reinstalled, but if you changed your motherboard, changed your video card, it had an algorithm that if you changed X amount too much, it would say, oh, you're on a, this is an illegal copy.
The point system thing? Is that the same?
Well, that's what led to that. That's what they've tried to refine it. But when XP first came out, that was the problem.
And I see.
It blew up on everybody's face. So Microsoft had to quit doing that. They disabled it in future versions of XP, and they also rolled out updates that turned that functionality off. Until August of this, well, summer of this past year of 2006, with their WGA, the Windows Genuine Authenticity Program, which is basically brought that functionality back. And people, I started getting phone calls left and right. You know, I'm not working, I'm a retired computer scientist there. I'm not supporting all these people anymore. I help out here at the station and such, and friends and such. But I started getting phone calls from old clients years back going, I've got this pop-up, what's going on? It's saying I have illegal software, what's going on? And it's not that I installed it, nobody knew. This was happening in the summertime, and there was no official announcement what was going on. So I hopped onto TechNet because my account was still valid, and found out in the private TechNet forums that, oh yeah, they had a whole bunch of bugs. These were, because some of these people had just bought these systems. They were like brand new Sonys and Toshibas and Dells and such, and they were getting these messages saying that they were on illegal hardware, or illegal software. It wasn't a valid copy. You needed to pay and register and all that. You have pirated software. And I lost track of dozens of phone calls, you know, people tracking me from years ago. And most of those turned out to be bugs. Two or three of them said, oh, yeah, well, I had my, you know, stepbrother Joe put a copy on, blah, blah, blah. I went, well, you got an illegal copy, you got busted, you're going to have to deal with it. Or you go to Linux, you know. But a lot of people who they said it was pretty legitimate, and I said, well, let me look into it, and I found out that it was bugs, and they were working on it, and it had a lot of false positives, and they were still refining it. By August, they rolled out another version of it that was less buggy, but it still had some false positives. Well, anyway, I ended up pointing, you know, these people towards going to, depending upon what their needs were, different versions of Linux, and about half of them ended up converting. They just went, you know what? We're sick of the viruses. We're sick of the spyware. We're sick of the crashes, you know, we're sick of slow running crap. You talked about this years ago. Where's it at now? What's it cost? What did it take to get it on our systems? And I'd give them the rundown, and about half of them converted. Some of them were offices, some were individuals. But just in from August through September last year, that was 20, I know of about 20 different entities. So an entity is either a person or an office, you know, a business that converted. Just because they rolled that WJ out and people just went, that's it, I've had enough. They reached their pain threshold. And so it'd be the same thing to see with Vista here is, you know, how much Microsoft pushes that pain threshold with people versus backs off and adapts.
Hmm. So, but the thrust of the argument is, I mean, the article is...
The thrust of their argument is that it's a security risk. But the security they're worried about is not the user's security, even though they make that claim. They make it clear later on that what they're really worried about is you could bypass the copy protection. Because it's running in a virtual machine, you'll be able to intercept calls to hardware, so you might be able to figure out a way to bypass Vista's copy protection, their DRM, for movies and music. Remember, that's built into Vista.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want that, so they're trying to cripple that under Vista.
So on the Mac, though, if you use their boot camp software,
right, that's which is mentioned here,
that's not virtualization, right?
Corey, I've never used it, so maybe Tom, if he's listening, he helps here at the station, and he's big Mac advocate, as I am about Linux, he is about Mac. So we've had some very interesting email discussions back and forth, very very cordial. Tom's a great guy. We just have our opinions. So they said it's unlike Apple's free boot camp program that lets Windows run on Mac. Parallels $80 virtualization product for Mac does not require users to have just one operating system. Okay, so boot camp only lets you run one OS. But it sounds like it does let you run Windows on Mac. But I don't know if it's like Wine. Wine lets you run Windows programs under Windows, but it's not a virtual machine. So I'll have to, let me make a note of that. I'll look it up, because that's a good question. I don't know anything about it.
Well, I know Parallels is virtualization. It runs it in a window.
No, that I get. And that's what the others are. So what I would suspect is Boot Camp is probably similar to the Wine project.
You have to reboot Boot Camp.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you have to reboot it and tell it you want to go into Windows, and then it just natively.
So kind of like
in.
When you went between OS 10 and OS 9, how you had to boot between the two, say switch to legacy mode?
I don't know about that, but okay. Yeah, I would assume.
I'll check it out. It sounds different. It doesn't sound like it's quite a virtual machine.
So in which case, then, what, Microsoft doesn't have a problem as long as you're booting directly?
Well, the thing is, they want to make sure they get your money, and they want to make sure that you can't bypass the copy protection that they've established with the MPAA and RIAA. Oh, and I have to apologize to everybody. I was planning to do an update on the status of lawsuits with the RIAA and MPAA for today's show, and I just ran out of time. I got parts of it, and I'll cover a little bit of it today, but I will be doing a lot more next week's show. We'll go into that in a lot more detail, just for those who are listening, expecting that. So anyway, that's they have multiple arguments. They claim it's because of security. Sounds like it's more concern over the copy protection, because the security aspect of it hasn't been proven yet. It's theoretical. There's no known serious issues. There are ways you can screw up if you set up a virtual machine that can open you up, but by default, it's not inherently more insecure. The other thing is that hardware vendors, both Intel and AMD, have made hooks in their processors now to make virtualization work better than ever before. And so Microsoft's concerned that that's opening up security holes as well, because a security expert last year produced on an AMD a possible security threat that she called Blue Pill. Take the red pill, take the blue pill. Okay, so here, talking about RIAA, got a couple here. RIAA to parents. Pop-ups plus viruses equals piracy. If a parent sees pop-up ads and viruses on her computer, he or she can be sued for copyright infringement by the RIAA. What this means is, see, a lot of what's been happening, RIAA has been taking a beating and losing now in court, whereas before they were just steamrolling. People are starting to fight back. And what was happening in the past was you'd get a nice, nasty letter saying, you, at this time period, were sharing this music software, and you owe $50,000 per copy, so we're suing you for $150,000. Here's the court, you know, you'll make your check out, too, you know. People would try to fight it, and they'd say, we'll settle for, how about you pay $6,000, you know. And so they're just getting these little snippets here, but still. And some of these people turned out to be their kids did it. But then other instances turned out to be, they didn't do it. Like little old ladies who don't even own computers, dead people, were getting sued. I mean, they keep making these mistakes, and the courts have fought back, because part of what the RIAA was doing was they would do the reverse of a class action lawsuit. So class action lawsuit is where you have a whole bunch of people signing on against one entity, right? Well, this was the reverse. This is one entity suing a whole bunch of people. And so they would say, we're suing 500 John Does. And they just list 500 John Does, because they only had the IP addresses. And they got away with that for a few years before finally the courts went, you can't do that. You have to give people the right to defend themselves as individuals. You can't just attack them all at once. You have to file each one individually. So, but they got away with it for several years, and people paid out of fear, just didn't dare fight it. But people are fighting back more and more. So in a recent court filing, Capital, that's with OL, versus Foster case, which a federal judge made the RIAA cough up attorney's fees at about $50,000 to a mother, Deborah Foster, who had been sued because her daughter was file sharing. The RIAA lawyers had dawdled in dismissing their complaint against Foster, even after child admitted being the file sharer on the house. The RIAA went ahead and got a default judgment against the child. However, the filing The new filing marks the first time RIAA has explained its claim that parents are liable to the infringement committed by their children, a theory that's never been accepted by any court, to the best of this article's knowledge. This is the EFF.org deep links by Fred von Lohmann. I'm quoting snippets from here. The RIAA brief, here's a relevant section, says, given that it has been established that the Kazaa file sharing program was on the Foster family's computer, the evidence would have established that the Kazaa icon was clearly visible on the computer when defendant was using it, and that there were likely a substantial number of pop-up advertisements, the types of which have been associated with the Kazaa program. In other words, the RIAA believes that pop-up ads and a system tray icon should put every parent on the hook for every download on the computer. In addition, it is disputed that defendant had an account with Cox Communications. Defendant's subscriber agreement with Cox made clear that defendant, as the account holder, was responsible for what is done on her account. So, Basically, but so I get that argument, and in this case, the daughter admitted that she did it. Okay, the problem is the majority. Remember, I've mentioning later this year we were just nailed with spam all over the internet because there were so many Windows computers that were infected and being used as spam servers. Well, the same thing is happening with file sharing. Your Windows computer gets taken over, unbeknownst to you, and used as a peer-to-peer file sharer. And there are millions of computers doing that to this day, of no intent. Nobody's intending to be a file sharer, but their computer and bandwidth's being used without knowing. And the RIA is saying, well, if you're having pop-ups, you know, so you might, you know, spyware causes pop-ups, but I know a lot of people, they've lived with it. They'll just trudge through because they don't know what to do. They're saying you could be liable, completely liable, even though you had no clue what was going on. And so they're trying to establish a precedent for that so that if people say, hey, I didn't know that I was infested with a virus and that they were using my computer, well, you had these pop-ups, so you're guilty. And so that's the argument they're trying to make there. On the flip side, well, no, it's not really flip side. More bad news.
Before you go on, can you explain that situation? I don't understand how the pop-ups were...
Kazaa, at least, so peer-to-peer file sharing programs, one of them is Kazaa. And when you download it, install spyware, adware, so it has pop-ups coming up. And so they're saying since you installed Kazaa, you would have had pop-ups, you the parents would have seen pop-ups, so that means you knew you had file sharing on your computer. That's their logic. So if you have pop-ups, you must have file sharing, so you had intent, you had knowledge, you had foreknowledge that your computer was file sharing, and so that's why you need to pay these fines. That's their argument they're making. Isn't that cute?
Pop-ups are kind of arguments. Commonplace.
Exactly.
From legitimate.
Exactly. This is the typical RIAA logic thread that they do all the time.
What does that stand for, again?
Recording Industry Association of America, and Sony is one of the biggest entities in it. So that's why I've been not only I first started boycotting the RIAA and MPAA about 4 or 5 years ago. I only buy like secondhand or independent artists, things like that.
So in this case, though, the teenager did something that was illegal?
Yeah, the girl, I don't know if they said she's a teenager or not, but the daughter admitted that she was file sharing without the parents knowing about it.
Knowingly. She chose to download something.
The daughter, let's see. The daughter, new filing. I believe that's what it says. That the daughter knew, but the parents did not know that she was file sharing. And they're saying, well, the parents should have known because of the pop-ups. And that the Kazaa icon was clearly obvious, etc., etc. But most people don't even know what that is. I don't know, you know, the kids are much more savvy than the parents in most cases. And my household's an exception. You know, I've got 12 computers in my office and things like that. But most parents don't know one-tenth what the kids now know on technology because they're hanging out on MySpace and YouTube. They know they are much more tech-savvy than any of the parents. And the parents want to spend more time with their kids, but they don't want to spend it on the computers trying to learn everything about it, even though that's a good idea. Anyway, so again, they're... concern is that the author here says that the parents are liable for infringements committed by their children, and he says that's a theory that's not been accepted by any court yet, to the best of this author's knowledge. So RIA is trying to establish a precedent here, two precedents actually. One is that, yeah, you're going to get sued for your children's behavior. I get that. I don't have a whole lot of argument about that, unfortunately. You got to be on top of your kids when it comes to that, unfortunately. It's unfortunate, but it's one of the consequences of being a parent. Keep that in mind. You're responsible for their actions, whether you like it or not. I got three boys, so... but what's worse, this is what's scary, is that if you have pop-ups popping up on your computer, and then you get a letter and stuff, and you say, well, yeah, I saw pop-ups... That's as good as pleading guilty that you already knew you were intentionally file sharing, even if you didn't know. So that's part of the precedent they're trying to get established. Seeing they even quote, you know, well, Kazaa, because it's known that Kazaa is a file sharing program, blah, blah. Every time they make one little seemingly small success, they then use that to fan out their attack even larger. So that's another one. So that's something to watch. It sounds like that the RIAA... Let's see. Well, hang on. There's another RIA one. I was just going to cover two of them today. Let's see, alleged infringement. Okay, so that's where it sounds like the family lost. In this case, somebody fought back, and now the RIAA is retaliating. This is this is the same one. It's just a different take on the same article. I didn't realize that didn't click. I need to get a little more sleep sometimes. It's the Debbie Foster was sued by member company. So this is a follow-up to the other one. Interesting, but it's through a different source. Whereas the other one was EFF Deep Links. This is through Wired News.
The interesting legal question, or one at least, that comes to my mind is, how do we categorize this behavior? Because I don't know legally where it stands that someone in your household, let's say a child, a minor, calls 900 numbers. Yeah. I know the phone company wants their money,
uh-huh.
or whoever, because the phone company is being expected to pay,
right.
to pass along the bill. And I don't know how those, I know there were issues like that, $1,500
yeah.
charges, and
yeah.
all bogus because, you know, at a party somebody used their phone. And so I think the owner of the phone had to go through a bunch of hoops, but eventually they would be exonerated.
Yeah, I think some agencies allow you an out, others do not. And so it's kind of, it's not standardized. It hasn't been standardized as far as what parents are liable for. But you see an increasing trend towards that. I mean, I don't remember which state it was. They were trying to make parents liable for their children skipping school. I forget which. That was happening about 2 years ago. Some state or city or district was trying to pass a bill that would say if your kids skip school, the parents are liable.
Well, I know
in some
that's.
Way, like
I
some
think
sort
that's
of fine
common.
Or something.
Because if
is that becoming more.
Well, yeah. If it happened at my kid's, he was in the Central Valley District. If it happened in elementary school a certain number of times, then the parents got a summons.
Yeah.
And you had to go appear before a judge.
Wow.
And explain and fun. Tell what you were going to do about it. I think yeah. that's common, yeah.
Is it? Okay. Boy, it sure wasn't that way when I was.
It probably was. We just didn't have the problem so much. Or maybe they didn't care. They just wanted those kids to go away.
I was going
to
say, it wasn't that way when I was in school when I wasn't in school.
Yeah, a little slip of the tongue there, huh?
Yeah. Well, so this is also about Debbie Foster. So it turns out it looks like the RIAA did lose the case, and the courts mandated that RIAA would have to pay Debbie Foster over $50,000 in legal fees to make up for her costs and such. What has come up with this in this article, and this is by Elliot Van Buskirk. Boy, what's with the Vons here? Van and Von? First one was Fred Von Lohmann. Now we have Elliot Van Buskirk. I wonder if they're just two different pen names. Anyway, the RIAA filed a motion for reconsideration to say, hey, we shouldn't have to pay the bill. You know, let's just drop the case, whatever. And so we'll see what happens. But one of the things that's going on is apparently it turned out, okay, I guess the daughter didn't confess to it, but her daughter said she was doing file sharing, but I guess this is looking a little interesting. Apparently, it turns out that the file sharing, so her daughter was file sharing, but it wasn't what they were being charged with, because there's different files, and so you're allowed, see, file sharing in and of itself is not supposed to be illegal, even though they're trying to make it illegal. It's what you share that is illegal. So you have a right, like if I want to share my music, I have every right to, and I do. If I want to share my documents, my personal creations, I can share them. That's completely legal. I have every right to, and I say, go ahead and share this. It's just the copyrighted material that you don't have permission to share that becomes the issue. But the tool is there for those who want to share. So in and of itself, file sharing is not supposed to be illegal, but the RIAA and MPAA has tried repeatedly and succeeded in some cases to make file sharing legal. And I've talked about this before about they in the MGM versus Grokster case a couple years ago cited, and this is really bad precedent, that the software developer becomes liable for the user's actions. So if I invented a special shovel that was really good at shoveling dirt, but somebody used it to kill somebody, I become liable. I mean, that's an exaggeration of the same concept. That motion, MGM versus Grokster, says that a software developer is liable for the misuse of their software.
Must be a little narrower than that.
Unfortunately, no. This is all over. When this happened about 2 years ago, I mean, there are articles everywhere.
But you could extrapolate that to say the manufacturer of
yes.
Windows
well,
allows you to break into other computers.
That's right. You could, in theory, if there was enough, if you had enough muscle behind you to take on Microsoft.
But they're in bed with each other, so for now. I mean, IBM and Microsoft were in bed together. So, but yeah, look up the MGM versus Grokster. They try to make it specific to software applications of specific utility, but they make the developer liable. And that I've watched development screech to a halt in the last 2-3 years. We had all these innovations coming out on this kind of networking, and it has screeched to a halt in the commercial industry. Now, open source has taken up some of the slack, but there were a lot of commercial programs that were going to capitalize. There were whole companies being founded on the benefits of peer-to-peer networking in a legal way, you know, completely legal, that screeched to a halt because now they've had to spend all their time on lawyers and can't spend any time on development. There's a lot of great ideas out there that they can't make them public for fear of liability because of the MGM versus Grokster case. So it's really unfortunate. So anyway, this other article comments on the same case. Apparently it turns out that the actual files that they're worried about was through their wireless network that was unencrypted and open, and somebody was using their wireless network, using their bandwidth to commit the crime that was being charged. So I guess as the case delved in and they did forensics, etc., more information was found. So the bad thing about this is the RIA wants to push that any Wi-Fi provider or anybody who has an internet connection is liable for any traffic on that account. So that means like all the coffee shops that have open hotspots, Wi-Fi hotspots, the McDonald's, all the other places start, and some of them are, you have to have an account and pay for and everything, like through T-Mobile and stuff like that. But others are just open Wi-Fi to make it so that students and others can get online at many, many, many places. Well, there is a risk to that. I mean, that is dangerous. When you do that, you make it so any hacker can use your connection to attack anybody and do anything you want. And in this case, you know, do file sharing. And so the RIAA wants to make the provider of the bandwidth liable.
Well, how does that differ from an ISP themselves?
ISP is not liable for their users' behavior.
Why not? I mean, if
that's how the internet's been set up.
If you're going to make,
because you can't have an open internet and control everybody to that level.
So why,
China tries to.
So why would somebody who's distributing their signal wirelessly be any different? I mean, aren't they?
Yeah, you'd think you'd get at least the same rights as the ISP, but. That's it, you know. I mean, I've always told people, encrypt your signal. Don't. And they're like, oh, I don't mind if people use my connection. And I don't mind if they use it. And I'm like, no, well, you set yourself up.
Do you know? Is it a crime? I heard it was a crime to use somebody else's wireless signal.
Only if they put some level of protection on it, encryption or whatever on it, that you have to bypass it. If it is unencrypted, you are saying this is freely available. It is not a crime.
Now, is that state by state, or what's the jurisdiction?
At this point, as far as I know, it is not a crime. Period. If it's unencrypted, because it's an open network, because there are, I mean, in the Bay Area and California and San Francisco, there's a whole community there. They've all intentionally opened up their networks, and you can drive all the way up the peninsula and be connected from hotspot to hotspot, or you can walk and be connected the whole time, free. Everybody's providing for free. It's called, it was called Free Baynet or something. I can't remember what they call it now, but it was a project back when I was working out there.
How do ISPs feel about that? Like the phone?
Well, they hate it. They hate it because it's maxing out all their bandwidth.
Exactly. Now, do they have rules against that?
Some have some rules and some don't, but they're variable and difficult to enforce because you can't really tell behind the firewall where all the traffic's coming from. You just see one. The ISP can't see behind your firewall normally. I mean, there are some, like AOL, you can. But normally you can't see behind the firewall, so you can't tell that you have 20 users back there versus one user. They can't tell. And there's no not totally invasive and thus security risking way to change that. So the user's supposed to be savvy and isn't, unfortunately. In a lot of cases, it's purely altruistic. They just want to share the bandwidth. But in other cases, bad things happen. That's why I always suggest put encryption, because that's like putting either a lock on the door or, yeah, basically a lock on the door. Encryption is a lock on the door. Yeah, it can be bypassed if somebody wants to, and pretty easily, but you're at least saying, stay out of my house. Mm-hmm. You know, the average person can't just knock on the door, open it, and walk in if you have the door locked. Same thing with encrypting your wireless. Put encryption on the wireless, and make sure you let them know that it's off limits. So we'll talk more about this on next week's show, in just the overall RIA and a lot of things going on. Got to wrap up here. We're down to the last 2 minutes, and then Science Radio is coming on the air. I hope you've enjoyed what we've been covering here. Sunday, I'll take about 15, 20 minutes to talk about just relevant headlines. I wasn't able to get all the headlines, like the open source. India has slated 500 million Indian children to have Linux systems.
500 million?
Million, half a billion. Half a billion children to have Linux. It's starting to get up there. That's more than the United States has people. We only have 300 million in the United States. So I'll cover some more, just the headlines Sunday, and then we'll get in more detail next week, Friday, noon to 1. Remember, you can download my podcast at techtalkhawk.com, TechTalkHawke.com. You can always listen online at KYRS.org. And next week we'll try to cover RIAA and MPAA and the lawsuits and status on that. You are listening to KYRSLP Spokane, 89.9 FM, also heard on 92.3. Thin Air Community Radio, www.kyrs.org, 509-747-3807.